From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There was a lot going on in December of 2010 in Washington, D.C. Two big legislative initiatives had run their course and were going to be decided. One was the repeal of the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy in the military. The other was the so-called DREAM Act, which would have created a path to citizenship for some young illegal immigrants. Now, both bills were close, but only one made it. The DREAM Act couldn't get enough votes. Senators killed it. Ali Nourani, who directs the National Immigration Forum, was deeply disappointed, but he says he learned a big lesson that day, that you can't resolve an issue so motivated by race and class just through politics. He says the part he missed was the culture part. Nourani is coming to Utah this week. Today in the program, he'll join us to talk about the new approach he's learning for talking about immigration after the news.
Purchase the books that you hear featured on Radio West by clicking the IndieBound, Amazon, or Audible links included with each show at RadioWest.org. A portion of proceeds from these affiliate partners supports Radio West. While you're there, you can check out all the show archives. Thanks for listening.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. A lot of people are trying to figure out why a big wall to keep immigrants out seems so appealing to so many Americans, and why rhetoric about a wall seemed to work so well for Donald Trump during the election. One of the things Ali Nourani, who directs the National Immigration Forum, has learned over the last several years is that people are scared of something. They're scared for their jobs. They're scared for their neighborhoods, what they see as their way of life. And yes, it sounds like racism or nativism or ignorance to some, and maybe there is some of that in these fears, but Nourani believes not only is it more complicated than that, but it also says those who really do want to find a workable solution for immigration are not going to get very far by calling their opponents stupid racists. Over the years, Nourani has been working out a different approach, one that's not just about politics and policy, but one grounded in a deeper understanding of culture. One of the places where he's learned this lesson, by the way, is here in Utah. So Nourani is returning to the state this week, and today in the program he's joining us to talk about his new approach, his idea of trying to meet people where they are. Ali Nourani is the executive director of the National Immigration Forum. It's a Washington-based advocacy group for immigrants and immigration. We're going to be talking a bit about his book, which is called There Goes the Neighborhood, How Communities Overcome Prejudice and Meet the Challenge of American Immigration. And he's joining us today from the studios of NPR in Washington. Ali Nourani, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Doug. It's great to be on the show.
I guess I want to begin with your own story. And this is one of the things in your book. You write about how you would prefer to tell the stories of others rather than have to tell your own story. But I guess at some point you figured that you were going to have to share your own story as part of this process, and so you reluctantly started to?
Exactly. When I first started, when I first had the idea of writing a book, I said, well, maybe I'll write a book about immigration policy and the history of immigration. And one of the first stories I started to uncover was how actually in Utah, Transcontinental Railroad met, and now on one side it was built by the Irish immigrants, and the other side the Chinese immigrants. And yeah, I realized that that's a really interesting and fascinating story, but the rest of immigration history and immigration policy is not so much. So I came to terms with the idea of interviewing almost 60 faith, law enforcement, business leaders across the country, but then along the way I just realized that the perch that I've had in this process and the fact that all these people were generous enough to share their stories with me, I really needed to share my story, my own story, as I started putting pen to paper.
Let's talk a little bit about your story. Your parents moved from Pakistan to California is where they ended up, and this was in 1971. So talk a little bit about your experience and how much your own identity has been shaped by immigration.
Sure. So I was born in Santa Cruz. My father, both of my parents were trained as physical therapists when they came into the U.S. And they ended up in Santa Cruz because that was a place where my father met another physical therapist who provided him the opportunities to get the training hours that he needed. And when I was about, I would say, 2 or 3 years old, we ended up moving about 40 miles to the south, to Salinas, California, which at that point only had one other physical therapist in town. So it was very much being in the right place at the right time for my family. And what happened is that, you know, my story of immigration is not only my parents coming to California in the early 70s from South Asia, from Pakistan, but, you know, taking a step back further than that for them, they were both born in Bombay. Mm. After partition, they ended up really growing up in Karachi, Pakistan. And then for me, it was living in a city like Salinas, which at that point was, you know, 60, 70,000 people, where the majority of folks in town were, as I put it in the book, you know, children of farm workers or children of farm owners. Mm. And the populations that I got to know were either, you know, white or Latino. And for me, it was a South Asian community of myself, my two sisters, and my parents. So, you know, looking back, that journey really, you know, got me to develop an appreciation for really working across, getting to know people across racial and cultural lines.
At what point did you start asking questions? I mean, it seems like a really critical part of almost a theme in the book, at least an indirect one, are the questions that we ask each other. Were you asking questions of some of those kids back in the day?
You know, probably not. You know, I think that a lot of the times for me at that point in my life, and even now, I'm more of a listener than an asker. Mm. And what I have a tendency to do, you know, just speaking for my personality now, is that, yes, I'll, you know, put a few questions out there, but I just let people talk and try to get a sense of where they're coming from, where they're going. But, you know, growing up, I was certainly one of the more quiet people in the room. And even now, I think I'm one of the more quiet people in the room, which makes this entire book tour thing all the more unsettling.
You write about these two experiences that left a really deep impression in Massachusetts, both of these particular experiences. One was in, I never know how to pronounce New England names. Is it Dorchester?
You can use every letter in that word.
Okay, good. Because it's always, I know it's Worcester, but is it Duster? No, okay, so it's Dorchester, Mass. And in Dorchester, you were working with these, or encountered the experience of these Vietnamese young people who were being deported for these juvenile crimes. But they were not, they were Vietnamese, clearly. But they were more American than Vietnamese. And that was an experience that you saw. And I want to have you talk about that particular one. And there's also an experience that seemed influential in New Bedford, Mass. Mm-hmm.
Well,
talk about those two things.
Sure.
And explain why this was important.
In Dorchester at that time, I was serving as the director of public health for two large community health centers in the neighborhood. One was the Dorchester House Multi-Service Center. The other was the Codman Square Health Center. And Dorchester is just an incredible incredible neighborhood. It's the largest neighborhood in the city of Boston. But you start at the Codman Square Health Center, which is one end of Dorchester Ave, or Dot Ave. And it's a Haitian community. It's an African-American community. And then you start walking down Dot Ave towards the Dorchester House. You pass an Irish community, a mix of folks who have been here for generations, as well as people who just come from Ireland. Then you pass through a, you know, Central American Latino community. Mm-hmm. And then in Fields Corner, where the Dorchester House is located, it's this bustling, thriving Vietnamese community. So in less than a mile and a half, you feel like you've gone around the world, which was just an incredible place to work. I lived in the community for a little while, and it really taught me a lot about, you know, how immigrants are really developing and developing neighborhoods in big cities. At Dorchester House, one of the programs that I managed was the after-school youth programs. And the majority of folks in Fields Corner, in that particular part of Dorchester, were refugees from the Vietnam War. And we got to work and got to know a set of the Vietnamese youth. And I remember we were hearing that they were getting in trouble with the law, you know, doing dumb kid things of getting in a fight or whatever. And we did a after-school seminar with a local immigration services organization, the PAIR Project, Political Asylum and Immigrants and Refugee Project. And I remember specifically Sarah Ignatius, who was executive director at that point, was talking to these youth and more or less made the point that if you get in a fight and your public defender says, you know, plead guilty and take community service, don't do that.
Yeah.
Because as soon as you plead guilty to, you know, something as innocuous as getting into a fight, it is a deportable offense. And I remember just for myself a realization at that time that, okay, you know, these kids are, you know, they're American, full
yeah.
stop.
Yeah.
They've, you know, many of them have never been to Vietnam. And here we are deporting them for, you know, what most all kids do is they get in some little amount of trouble. And it was just merely a function of them coming as refugees and not having become U.S. citizens yet. So it was a very clear moment for me that there was just something going on in the immigration system that was impacting the neighborhood that I was working in a really, really personal way. The second incident was in 2007.
Yeah.
I was at that point running the statewide immigrant rights coalition called the Massachusetts Immigrant and Refugee Advocacy Coalition. And in March of 2007, I remember I had just landed from a quick vacation. I can't even remember where we went. I think I might have gone to Miami, but I landed. I turn on my phone, and the phone is just, you know, voicemails through the roof. It turns out that in New Bedford, which is a city about 70 miles south of Boston, there was an immigration raid where over 350 undocumented immigrants who were sewing backpacks for the military were swept up in a very high-profile, military-level almost, immigration raid. And what happened is that the organization that I was running, we helped lead the response, where we set up a crisis response center in a local church in New Bedford, worked with so many of the local organizations, the local elected officials, and really just tried to provide the community the information that they needed. And the story that sticks in my head from that moment is that one of the things that we were trying to do is one of the men, his wife had been detained, and he had a newborn. So he was very worried that his newborn wouldn't get the nutrients that she needed. So we were pressing to try to get his wife released. And in fact, I think we had an NPR interview lined up for 2 p.m. And at noon, he gets a phone call from immigration enforcement that his wife's been released. So we're like, okay, this is great. He's saved. Yeah. His family's okay. He's not going to make it back for the interview. And he comes back at 2 p.m. And I remember us asking, it's like, why are you here? You're fine. And this was a person who was never really active in the community, didn't see himself as a leader. But I remember him telling us, he says, well, this is my community. I have to fight. And it was just such a poignant moment in that the community was under such incredible pressure and the world's attention was turning to New Bedford. And this guy was, you know, his family was safe, but he still felt like he needed to convince the American public that what was happening was wrong.
Mm. At what point did it first start to occur to you that this was bound up in culture? You know, how was your thinking in the early days about all of this, and mm-hmm. and when did the culture part start to occur?
Well, actually, that the immigration raid that I just talked about in New Bedford, I remember as we were thinking through the strategy of, okay, how do we explain this incident to the general public, and we felt that if we used the term, the phrase immigration raid or enforcement, it wouldn't strike a chord. We couldn't really explain the human impact of this action on to the public. So we made a very deliberate decision to frame the incident as a humanitarian crisis.
Yeah.
And I remember, in fact, all of our all the press work that we did in that church basement was always the podium surrounded by volunteers and food, blankets, diapers that were donated by the community. So that way, it was a very clear picture that this was, this wasn't just an abstract enforcement action. This was a humanitarian crisis caused by the federal government. And it was at that point where I think I started to realize that we had to engage with the general public in a way that was not about immigration policy. It was really about the impact of immigration on people. And that's when we started to again, just understand that, you know, if we're just operating in a political or a policy frame, we're not actually moving the needle. We're not helping people understand what the real issues are.
Is it, so the word you use is culture, and we'll break that down a little bit later, but is essentially what you're saying is make it personal?
Exactly. And, you know, President Trump, I think, has one of the things that he has done so brilliantly is that he has taken a number of different policy questions and made it so that, you know, the American worker, made it so that it seems so incredibly important and personal to the American worker and their family. And when it comes to immigration, he's obviously done that in a way that I think undermines our future prosperity, our nation's values around this question of immigrants and immigration. But regardless, he has been able to communicate in a way that's so personal and visceral to individuals across the country, or again, the range of issues, that, you know, for those of us who care about immigrants and immigration, you know, we've got to stop talking about this as a policy question. And I give a lot of credit to the Dreamer movement, which is the population of young undocumented immigrants who have personalized this issue around their stories, around the stories of their families. So, you know, I think when undocumented youth really started to explain to the public that this is their immigration status and they're, as they put it, undocumented and unafraid, you know, the American public, you know, they couldn't turn their head away from that.
There's a story you tell in the book early on, and I wanted to ask you about it because I find it really interesting. Former Connecticut Senator Joseph Lieberman comes into the Capitol on the Jewish Sabbath. Now, he's an observant Jew, and he's there for the Dream Act was playing out. I mentioned it in the introduction. Mm-hmm. There was a lot going on. What was it? December 18th, I think it was, in 2010. And Senator Lieberman shows up. But the gesture, I think, of him showing up as an observant Jew on the Jewish Sabbath was important. And you talk about seeing his culture and his values as playing a part in that gesture. And I wanted you to just tell that story and talk about why that seemed to say something to you about culture.
Sure. So on December 18th, 2010, the two items up for debate by the U.S. Senate was the Dream Act and then the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Yeah. And I remember going into the news going into that Saturday. There were several reports of whether or not Senator Lieberman would come to the Senate to cast his vote, because, like you said, it was on a Saturday, and also the vote on both issues was likely to be very close. So, you know, every vote really counted. And I remember, you know, that morning, you know, it was a cold winter morning, and we were at an elevator, kind of waiting to go upstairs, and you know, senators are starting to filter in, and just that door swings open. And, you know, if that door swings open, that particular door swings open, it's not a member of the general public. It's, you know, a senator or you know, somebody who's, you know, quite important. So the door swings open, there's Senator Lieberman, and it's clear that, you know, he walked to work. We all knew he had walked to work, and but it was clear, you know, he walked in, and the way I put it is that he shook the cold off of his coat.
Right.
And it stuck in my mind because, you know, this was a person who, you know, thought that these votes were so important to, you know, the country and aligned with who he was and what he believed, you know, based on his culture and his values, that, you know, later that day when, you know, the Dream Act had been defeated, it all slowly started to fit together for me. I thought, okay, if Senator Lieberman, an observant Jew, took this step to, you know, walk to work and take this vote, what do we need to do to reach other members of Congress, other members of the public who may or may not be Jewish, but they have a similar belief in, you know, their faith. Mm-hmm. And so how do we engage them on this question of, and, you know, of their values to get them to a place where, yes, they're going to walk to work if they have to vote in favor of immigration?
It's interesting that you didn't think that was being done, that you weren't appealing to senators, not just their faith, but something even deeper inside them, their kind of their humanity. And it's interesting that it just occurred to you then that wasn't really being done. At least it doesn't seem to you that was being done on this debate.
Well, the entirety of, 2008 and 2010, or, not even 8 and 10, like going back to 2006, that's when, at a national level, we started to create this narrative that the Latino vote was something to be contended with. If you're a member of Congress, if you want to run for president, you've got to have the Latino vote on your side, or the Asian vote on your side, or the New American vote on your side. So for a good, 4 or 5 years between 2006 and 2010, we had really been driving this very political narrative that getting to immigration reform depended on the political power of the community. And I'm not, let me be clear, is that that's a big part of this. Without the energy and the vitality of the base, nothing else happens. But, as you look across the country, look at Utah, for example. There are not enough Latino voters in Utah to swing a congressional district at this point. And there may or may not ever be.
Yeah.
So you have to engage members of Congress on something in addition to or other than an electoral narrative. And in 2010, in the run-up to that moment, we, at least as the National Immigration Forum, we were not doing that whatsoever. And I was looking back, would we have gotten to a win if we had changed our strategy? I'm not sure. But I do think that we would have forced a deeper debate among Republicans and even some Democrats.
It's interesting, if you contrast your efforts that, frankly, that failed in 2010. The Dream Act did not pass. But Don't Ask, Don't Tell was repealed. They used a different approach. And when we come back from a break, I want to talk about the difference, because it seems you've learned some lessons there as well. Ali Noorani is with us. His book is There Goes the Neighborhood, How Communities Overcome Prejudice and Meet the Challenge of American Immigration. He's going to be in Utah giving, and we'll give you details about that, by the way. Tonight at 7 o'clock, he's giving a reading at the King's English Bookshop. You can get details on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are talking about the immigration debate, which sometimes seems impossible to solve these days. But Ali Noorani, head of the National Immigration Forum, thinks he may have found at least a new approach. He's been traveling to different places like Utah, and he thinks the answer, if there's an answer to this conflict, is an understanding about American culture and identity. Noorani is in Utah this week, joining us today to talk about the challenge of American immigration. He's going to be speaking at the King's English Bookshop tonight. Tomorrow, he's the keynote speaker at the Salt Lake Chamber's American Dream Awards Luncheon. We'll give you more details about that a little bit later on the program. He's joining us from the studios of NPR in Washington. So let's go. I want to dig in on 2010 and talk about, as I mentioned, the Dream Act failed to pass, but the Don't Ask, Don't Tell was repealed. And there was a difference in the way both of those were handled. And I wanted to break down some of this, because you talk about, you say supporters of repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell dealt with things in different ways. And I wanted to ask about a few of these. One of them, you say they respected military culture. They developed a policy framework that established a kind of consensus. They understood that the public wanted to hear these stories. Was this a strategy? Talk a little bit about the difference.
Sure. So, I should say up front that I think they are very different issues. I think there are things that obviously we need to learn from the LGBT community, but the immigrant rights front, we deal with questions of race and class that are just very different than what has had to be contended in the LGBT community. But in any case, in the run-up to the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and again, this is the same time period where in the immigration movement we are really kind of pushing a political or electoral strategy. In the Don't Ask, Don't Tell space, there was an effort really to engage military leaders, engage members of Congress based on the question of military service, on the question of, family. I remember that there were studies done by the Department of Defense. There were there was validation from highly respected military leaders who were, you know, Republican as well as Democrat. So it was not, but it was never a question of, you know, if, you know, we have more voters than, you know, the opposition. It was always the question of, you know, should somebody have the right to openly serve in the nation's military based on who they are? And it was, again, a question of, you know, they engage in a cultural conversation with the military establishment, with members of Congress, and with the general public. And that was just incredibly different from what we did in the immigration space, again, with the exception of efforts by the Dreamers to introduce themselves as individuals who are members of families to the public. But that was, you know, for the most part, drowned out by a much larger political debate.
One of the things you said is you failed at the moment to understand the seriousness of, as you put it, the country's cultural crisis. What were you saying? What do you mean, cultural crisis?
Well, what I was getting at there, and in that first chapter, I also interview Jorge Ramos, who is one of the most, you know, highly respected, if not the most highly respected, journalists in the Latino community. And it was an interesting interview I did because I kind of was expecting him to disagree with me in that he would make the case that it's all about politics. But in our conversation, we both realized that as a movement, we assumed that, you know, the middle of the country was just as happy about the demographic change that came with immigration that folks in Miami were happy about, or the big cities or the coasts. And as a result, what we did is that we ignored the anxiety that they were feeling, that culture anxiety, really the identity crisis that, you know, these communities were going through. And we kind of assumed that everybody else was just as happy as us. And, you know, as a result, we failed.
Yeah. What was the thing that you missed? That it was about more about demographics in some way? That people were afraid of? They just had anxiety about what all of this meant for their future, I suppose.
I think we missed the anger.
Yeah.
Right? And I think that whether or not we ever acknowledged it, I think that we felt that if we tried to understand the anger, we were validating the anger. And opponents to immigrants and immigration reform, they see that anger, they see that fear, they see that anxiety, and they prey on it to their benefit. The fact is that for years we had ignored that anger, if not outright dismissed it, to our peril, and, you know, in 2010 to our failure.
Why isn't it just racism or nativism?
I think it's a combination of race and class is what, in terms of the source of these anxieties. It's not just, you know, people see their communities changing. They see, you know, the town, the community one town over changing. It doesn't look like them. It doesn't sound like them. And it's wrapped up in this question of, is that person potentially from another country going to come and take my job? So I do think that there's there, later in the book, I had cited a survey or analysis of the Gallup survey that came out last summer that found that your Trump voter lived in a culturally isolated community, but also voted for Donald Trump because they felt like their child would not do better than them. Yeah. So it's this combination of kind of the cultural isolation with the economic anxiety that is just really, really difficult to untie.
I wanted to ask you about this kind of this term, meet people where they are. When did this occur to you?
A big part of implementing this strategy has been to, as an organization, kind of change our own approach. Now, as an organization, the National Immigration Forum has always had in its DNA coalition building like this to some degree. But in this political environment, at this moment in time, it has really taken a lot for the organization and just the incredible staff that we have to kind of get out of our comfort zone. And what we realized is that we were asking other people to get out of their comfort zone, but we weren't necessarily getting out of ours. And this came up over and over for me personally, where, you know, I just for years I would, you know, pontificate, well, you know, the political right needs to move to the left. And, you know, kind of get to know their immigrant neighbors. And, you know, again, that was me not really acknowledging what fears and anxieties people are facing. So over time, it has come, you know, our informal motto as an organization and for me personally is to meet somebody where they are, but not leave them there. And what I'm getting at there is that, you know, I'm going to have a conversation, like I was saying earlier, I'm going to have a conversation with you. I'm going to ask one or two questions, but I'm going to spend most of my time listening. Because in that, if we get to a place where it's a comfortable enough conversation where you are telling me, okay, this is where the anxiety is coming from, I know where to go with that over time.
Yeah.
But if I go into that conversation and assume that we're on the same page or we're never going to agree, then we're not leaning towards each other.
Before you came here to Utah, what did you think of this place?
I thought Utah was known for its skiing, for movies once a year, and for a Mormon community that was, you know, very insular and sheltered from the rest of the country, if not the world. So I just thought of it as a kind of on one hand a playing ground for the elite, and on the other hand, a very insular and closed off state. And I was clearly wrong.
You came here looking to find out what. You were taken by the efforts of Utah policy leaders to deal with this question, and I guess you were surprised by it.
Right. And this all, 2010 was such a pivotal moment for me personally and for us as an organization because, you know, while we had the run-up to the DREAM Act over the course of the year, also the other kind of flashpoint in 2010 was that in Arizona, we saw SB 1070 pass. This was the Show Me Your Papers law, where, in essence, local law enforcement in the state of Arizona could have asked anybody for their immigration papers based on, you know, just any sort of suspicion. The law was eventually struck down for the most part by the Supreme Court. But for proponents of the law at that time, Utah was the next state on the list. So we had on contract an organizer in Utah, Carter Livingston, who started to kind of look around and see what was happening. And there started to be some conversations among the business community and others of, okay, how do we kind of get ahead of this? And the Salt Lake Chamber, the Catholic Church, Chief Burbank, Chris Burbank at the time for the city, and others started to have some informal conversations. But for me, the moment that really caught my attention in D.C. was that in the summer of 2010, five state workers took it upon themselves to release a list of thousands of people that they alleged were undocumented immigrants using state benefits.
Yeah. This is what they called the hit list.
The hit list, exactly. Yeah. And in reality, the list was merely just a name. You know, everybody there had a Hispanic surname.
Yeah.
But we did this press conference in a telephonic press conference, as the story became caught national attention. And it was then Attorney General Mark Shurtleff who was answering a question. And Mark said, this is not a hit list, it's a blacklist, and I'm going to do everything in my power to prosecute these individuals. And so from my perspective, I'm thinking, okay, Utah is the most conservative state in the country. It has, you know, this top-tier conservative leadership is not condoning, if not these actions, wants to make sure that, you know, things are that these individuals are prosecuted. You know, what's going on here? So that began a process for me to really just try to learn about how these conversations were fitting together, and, you know, why was Utah a place where a different sort of approach could be developed.
One of the things you write is that the LDS Church's engagement on immigration is embodied throughout Mormon culture. You write this. You say, yes, it's a community that sticks pretty hard and fast to religious principles, but you write, their willingness to engage global society through their dedication to missionary work allows them to move with the times and to broader society. So give me a sense of what you're seeing within the LDS Church. Is it just this sort of pragmatic effort at trying to proselytize globally? Or is there something else embodied in Mormon culture that you're seeing that can be helpful?
As I was researching the book and doing interviews all around the country, I was in Salt Lake last spring in April of last year. And I happened to be there on a weekend for the general conference was occurring.
Right.
And this was the same time that the refugee debate was reaching a fever pitch, particularly with regards to the Syrian refugee question. And the LDS Church had weighed in multiple times. But this afternoon session of General Conference was very was moving because Elder Kieron, his sermon focused on the plight of refugees.
This is Elder Patrick Kieron.
Yes.
Yeah. Go ahead.
And he spoke to not just the journey of the Syrian refugee, the willingness and the commitment and the dedication of the Mormon community to helping refugees, but also whether it's his sermon or others that I read over time, it was always tied back to the history of the Mormon Church and their journey from Eastern United States to Utah eventually. And then as I was talking to folks at the church itself, I learned that, for example, many people who become Mormon but are undocumented, they cannot complete a mission outside of the country. So the church all of a sudden was caught up in this question of, okay, their members who are undocumented, their travel and their ability to serve is now limited.
Right.
So I guess what I'm getting at here is that the church, by not being anywhere near as insular as I thought, as I assumed it was from the outset, was engaging in a global society and in ways that I wasn't even expecting just on this question of immigration and refugees.
You write that the politics of immigration changed in Utah because the politics were informed by religious values. And I guess the big question is, can you transfer that idea? I mean, is Utah, think about the evangelical South, for example. Can you transfer that same Christian idea that you're seeing in Mormonism? Doesn't seem to translate as well.
You're absolutely right, and that's a question that I pose in the book, is that Utah is ethnically, religiously homogenous.
Yeah.
Yep, but so is Alabama.
Right.
Right? But they have two very, very different approaches to these questions. So in other parts of the book, I spend some time in South Carolina. Mm-hmm. Again, and, not as homogenous as Utah, but still, it's dominated by by and large, evangelical community as a white community. And there are pockets that are really engaging this question they're struggling with it in an honest way. There are other pockets that are like, okay, we don't want immigrants here or for refugees here, full stop. So I think in other states across the country that are religiously and ethnically homogenous, we are seeing more and more that there is a debate, that there is a conversation among conservatives. Okay, what's the way to proceed from a faith perspective, from a law enforcement perspective, from a business perspective? And that wasn't happening, 5-10 years ago. It was much more of a monolithic, we don't want immigrants here in the South, full stop.
So wait, so one of the lessons you learned from Utah was that, including a Christian principle. Mm-hmm. Could work. That could be a way to appeal to people in a way that hadn't occurred to others in the past.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I think that what I took away from it was that for the LDS Church to play such a constructive role in the debate, in the immigration debate in Utah, I began to wonder, okay, in the other parts of the country, how can the evangelical community, how can the Catholic community play a larger and larger role? And I'm not saying that up to that point they weren't playing a role. There are certainly pockets across the country where Catholics and evangelicals have long led efforts to engage the public in an immigration dialogue. But it was nowhere near reaching any sort of a level of scale that was necessary, or much less of what we saw in Utah.
Ali Nourani is with us, Executive Director of the National Immigration Forum, author of the book There Goes the Neighborhood, How Communities Overcome Prejudice and Meet the Challenge of American Immigration. Tonight at 7 o'clock, he's giving a reading at the King's English Bookshop in Salt Lake City. Tomorrow, he's the keynote speaker at the Salt Lake Chamber's American Dream Awards Luncheon. It recognizes the contributions of immigrants in our community. There are details about all of those events on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another quick break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Ali Noorani. He's the executive director of the National Immigration Forum. It's a Washington-based advocacy group for immigrants and immigration. He's in Utah today and tomorrow. We'll give you some more details about that as we go along. He's joining us from a studio in NPR in Washington. I want to ask you, was there any new development in the 2016 election? All of this talk about building a wall and getting Mexico to pay for the wall. I mean, did you see anything at all in that that was different, any kind of different spin? Or is it the same thing you'd seen before?
You know, I'll answer your question. I'll answer a slightly different question, but I think it's related.
Okay.
A lot of people have asked me, you know, did you have to change anything in the book after the election?
Yeah.
All right. And much to my surprise, I hardly changed anything, which, you know, is to some degree, I'm not sure if I feel good about that.
Yeah. That showed you this is a static issue we need to deal with. It's not really budging.
Yeah, and everybody I talked to, you know, I should say the majority of the people that I talked to were politically and socially conservative. You know, a number of them told me they were voting for Donald Trump. So just through the context of those conversations, I couldn't help but to, you know, write a book that, you know, spoke to what are the anxieties of a much broader swath of America than probably most other immigration books. And as a result, when Donald Trump won, you know, as I kind of went back through it one last time before we sent it to the printer, I realized, okay, nearly everything that people have told me that, and I've then interpreted and written about, remains the same. Mm-hmm. You know, we've got to engage in this question based on culture and values, not politics and policy, because, you know, the fear and the anxiety that candidate Trump tapped into is not going to be addressed by a policy question, and certainly not going to be addressed by a political question.
Yeah. You quote Daniel Stid of the Hewlett Foundation in your book, and he says this, and this is really interesting. Polarization is neither a trend that can be reversed nor a problem that can be solved. Rather, it's a predicament with which we need to learn how to cope. And one of the models that you – this was one of the most intriguing things, and I thought one of the most original approaches. I'm not sure if it'll work, but is this transpartisan model, this idea of, as opposed to trying to find people who are somehow ideologically in the center or neutral, if that's possible, which I don't think it is, but is to find people who do have ideological credibility on either side of, you know, whichever ideology they happen to be, and get them to talk. Am I getting that right? Am I accurately describing how it works?
Absolutely. And it was funny when I came upon that research. I mean, as you see, it's in the last chapter. Yeah. And so it was really at the tail end of the entire writing process. But when I found that article, the articles, and I read the stuff by Jonathan Haidt, it all began to make sense. Because, you know, between that moment in 2010, you know, getting to know folks in Utah who had created this amazing Utah Compact and kind of where we are today, what we as an organization have done, and I've just been, you know, been really dumb lucky to be able to engage this range of leadership, is to engage the evangelical pastor, the police chief, the local business owner, you know, with whom I probably personally, you know, agree with on nothing else other than immigration. But we found a point of connection around this really difficult question. And, you know, they'll have a different perspective on it than I will. But at the end of the day, they are trusted by an audience that we need to reach. But and that has been really the most important thing.
What are those conversations like? I mean, I just keep seeing these conversations working toward an impasse because you have people of different ideological viewpoints. And once you get to that point where you work yourself to that impasse, then what?
Well, it's funny. It's like, in one of the earlier stages of us creating this strategy, we did a meeting in D.C. where on one side of the table, there was, you know, business leaders, the Chamber of Commerce and others. And the other side of the table were faith leaders from the evangelical community. And this is the first time where, you know, folks on the business side are like, oh, these folks actually, they're bringing some juice to the table.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it dawned on them the size of, you know, Christian America in terms of, you know, really trying to think about and grapple with these questions. So it was a great first conversation. And then we came to this impasse, which was interesting because the business guys would come to us and say, hey, can we get the pastors to talk about work visa program X or work visa program Y? And I said, no, probably not. It's not what, you know, that's not what they're in this for. Yeah. They're in this for family. They're in this for compassion. You're in this for economics, and that's fine. But they still wanted to have the conversation. You know, so yes, it was an impasse, but it wasn't a fatal blow to the coalition. Let's put it that way.
You also had pushback from the left, though. People were really worried you were giving the right too much power, that you were ceding ground, I guess.
Yeah, that to me was the most interesting because I found that I had to spend a good year almost really explaining to our allies on the left of, okay, this is why we want to bring conservatives into this conversation, because ultimately in order for us to get to the necessary number of votes, they're going to be the ones that are going to support their member of Congress. And it was, I still don't understand kind of where the anxiety came from on the left, but you know, kind of given where we are now and given the journey of the last couple of years, we have to do a whole lot less explaining. And I think we've started to create a space and a level of credibility with both the left and the right as, you know, what I hope is a fair arbiter of these conversations. And, you know, eventually we'll get to a policy discussion, but, you know, we've got a lot more work to get there.
I wonder if, you mentioned in the book the way we categorize race, for example, and ethnicity, that's becoming increasingly irrelevant. And one of the things that you talk about is that intermarriage is going to really change the dynamic of this conversation and maybe even our sense of identity, I suppose. So how is the drastic change that's coming going to affect the conversation? Are we going to even need to have the conversation in 15 years because our identity will change so much? Or is that wildly naive?
I think that a lot of people will put this as, well, demographics is destiny,
right?
Where, you know, the country will become so diverse that these will no longer be relevant questions. I don't believe that. Yeah. I think that, you know, the journey of demographics will always turn up these conversations and these tensions and these anxieties. So that, yes, okay, California is going to only become more and more diverse. The rest of the country is not California. Utah is certainly not California demographically and will never be. So you have to engage Utahns based on a conversation based on a cultural framework and a values framework. The way that one of the people I interviewed was Dick Longworth, who was a journalist with the Chicago Tribune, and he wrote a book for me that kind of triggered a lot of these thoughts for me. It's called Caught in the Middle. And when I was interviewing him, he gave me a great line, and he said, you know, to paraphrase, it doesn't matter how high Donald Trump's wall is, it's never going to block hormones.
Right.
So yes, you know, intermarriage and diversity will be a bigger part of the U.S., but, you know, that's a long, long time before, you know, the country is so diverse that these questions are not relevant. I'm not sure that day ever really comes.
Yeah. You say what all of this does require is a vehicle through which you have the dialogue and these relationships, and where you do. What's the forum? You know, you went to various dinners and had these. I mean, but how do you create that? You know, you also talk about finding space. So what does that look like? What is that supposed to look like? I suppose it can be different to different places.
Well, what we found is that, and this all happened incredibly organically, is that we started to find a coalition or a network being developed that came to be known as Bibles, Badges, and Business for Immigration Reform.
Yeah.
And the basic, you know, values proposition that we'd make is that if you hold a Bible, you wear a badge, or you own a business, you want a common sense solution to the immigration system. And people see themselves in that phrase. They see themselves as, they see somebody that they can trust on this question. They can trust their pastor. They can trust their police chief. They can trust, you know, a small business owner. Or maybe they can't trust one of them, but they can trust the other. So what we've done as the National Immigration Forum over the last 5 years is build out this network so that, you know, it doesn't matter, almost in practically every state, there is a combination of faith, law enforcement, business leaders in, you know, speaking to the value of immigrants and immigration. And sometimes that's, you know, very specific in support of a specific piece of legislation. In most cases, especially at this time, it is really just creating the public event, the public conversation where these different perspectives are shared. And that provides the public the range of messaging, the range of arguments that can eventually change their hearts and their minds.
Is it starting to work?
I think so. That's a tough question to ask in April 2017 after the last 6 months.
Yeah.
I really do think so, though. You can point to the polling, and you can always look at the polling and says, you know, anywhere between 50 and 60% of, you know, Republicans want a common sense solution to the immigration system. My indication is that I rely on is, you know, who are the new voices that we're bringing into the debate? You know, in the book, I talked to Republican attorneys general, Republican sheriffs, farmers in eastern Washington. In Idaho, just up the road from you all, I was there about a month ago and met with the Idaho Dairymen Association. Half of the room absolutely had voted for Donald Trump. But to a person in the room, 75 dairymen, they were terrified about the direction of the nation's immigration debate because their workforce had been with them for over 10 years and who they come to see as an extension of their families and their community were terrified to go to work. So, and they were starting to make sure that their voices were being heard by the congressional delegation and the administration. So it was hard. It's hard to see whether or not you're making progress. After the work of the last 5 years, after working on the book, I can't help but to have a sense of optimism and hope that, you know, we are on the right track. It's just a bumpy track.
It's Ali Noorani. His book is There Goes the Neighborhood, How Communities Overcome Prejudice and Meet the Challenge of American Immigration. Tonight at 7, he's giving a reading at the King's English Bookshop. Tomorrow at noon, he's delivering the keynote address at the Salt Lake Chamber's American Dream Awards Luncheon. You can get the particulars by going to our website, radiowest.org. Ali Noorani, thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to David Boyle. We had technical direction today from Michael Havey. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.